6 weeks? That's, we're all about the 6 to 8 week area. So you know the problems that you have encountered have probably not been handicapping problems, but problems of getting around the language and the lack of rules. Check me if I'm correct, and things like that. You're not a newcomer, Chief. How you doing? Good to see you. And you want to commit a homicide, better not do it. New York's finest is here. Correct me if I'm incorrect, but my impression is that when you get the methodology as a newcomer, your biggest problem is having to alter a long-standing point of view on what constitutes a handicapping process. And the fact that the manuals are not written like recipe books, they don't say step one, here's step two, step three, and that there are no rules, and that there are messages in there which go counter to what everybody has been taught by the so-called experts. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yeah.
Okay. Then that was all done purposely. I hope you understand. We have in this country millions and millions of dollars worth of systems sold every year. And over a 10-year period, it amounts into the billions of dollars. And essentially, the systems that are being sold are systems that were conceived in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and they're just rewriting them. What does every system have a set of? Rules. Why do system sellers who want to prey on the money of people print books with rules? Because as children, you were taught that everything must have a rule. There's a rule for everything. Everything is governed by rules. Handicapping, successful handicapping, and I'm talking about now the people who are successful, which are there several thousand in this country and Canada. All of them will tell you that there are no rules for successful handicapping. Successful handicapping is done quite easily if you can understand the relationships of patterns. It's pattern recognition. We say that each race is a unique celebration. It's a unique event. And yet, each race has, in truth, been run hundreds and hundreds of times before. And if you recognize the patterns that win under the circumstances that you view in the racing form, then you will be able to be a winner without rules. There are guidelines. There are factors which are dominant. There are factors which are negative. But what we're trying to do, the reason it is so difficult, seemingly difficult, we were trying to show you how to win. The Yellow Manual was, in essence, an odyssey of one person who went from knowing nothing to becoming a winner, myself, with the help of 32 convicts. So let me tell you the process we went through from total ignorance to winning, just very briefly, and maybe then you can adapt yourself to this kind of thinking. So I think that if you really, truly understand this story, you will immediately drop your resistance to a few strange words that you never encountered before, and drop your resistance to something which is designed solely for winning and not for handicapping. We are not concerned with all the myths that all your experts love to prate about, because they do not contribute to winning. They contribute to being a very, very knowledgeable horse player, but they don't contribute to winning. So you have to decide whether you want to sit around and talk horsey talk with a bunch of horse players, or whether you want to cash tickets. So that is a personal decision that everybody has to make on their own. I started off by volunteering to take on some pathological gamblers into therapy from a group called the Roadrunners, which is a protective association for truck drivers. And their problem with these truck drivers, the reason they needed protecting, is that they had two major areas which caused them to get arrested, to commit crimes, and to lose their licenses. The two major areas were alcoholism and compulsive gambling. Sometimes the two went together. I chose not to mess around with the alcoholics because there were other organizations who could handle it. Alcoholics are not very amenable to psychotherapy. They're much better treated through Alcoholics Anonymous and a like kind of group. An alcoholic will not keep a clinical contract. He will lie to you and not keep it. And it's just a heartache to work with alcoholics because they will not keep. A gambler will. A gambler will keep a contract. And that's the essential ingredient of winning, is to keep a contract with a person who is trying to teach you the process. So I took these persons who had gambling-related felonies, and they were pretty bad. These guys had been convicted of major felonies and high misdemeanors. They would let their truck stand by the side of the road while they went to a cockfight in South Tucson or played craps in Vegas or Reno or wherever. When they got into some kind of a gambling game or event, they not only would let their refrigeration go off, they would hawk parts of the truck, their jacks, their tires, and pretty soon the whole truck they were selling. They would sell the food or whatever goods they were carrying clandestinely and black marketly and end up with nothing. And police would come and get them, and their employers would say, I'm going to fire you, and they were going to go to jail, but this organization stepped in. And they got them provisional licenses so they could keep jobs or get jobs until such time as they were cured. The provisional licenses were based on them going into some form of psychotherapy. So I volunteered to take these people on. Now, naturally, if the judges who assigned them to me knew what I was about to do, they would have put me in jail. And probably I'd have lost my license and been disgraced. But these guys, one thing I know about cons, because I worked in penitentiaries, is a con, correct me if I'm wrong, Lieutenant, but a con, if you don't con him, is a mum. He will not snitch on you if he's going to get some benefit. There's an honor among thieves to the degree that if you tell them, hey, we've got to keep this a secret, we can't let society know about it, we're all going to be in trouble, they will not tattle on you. I can testify they didn't. But instead of, and my only sin was trying a new procedure for cure that was not accepted by the American Psychiatric Association or the Psychological Association or society in general. After I tested them and found out they were not truly compulsive, I kicked four of them out who were truly compulsive. I couldn't have done a thing with them. But I ended up with 32 in groups of 8. My decision was that their problem was not gambling, their problem was losing. And I ascertained that the cure for losing is winning. I took on a big step here because I knew nothing about winning. I had never played, and once I played craps in Vegas, I came up to the table and I took the dice and I threw it and I went all the way over the thing into the floor into the next corridor, and the guy looks at me and I said, that's it. That's it. I played 21 a couple of times, always came up with 22. Gave that up. Played roulette. Whichever dozen I was on, the other dozen won. Dick Schmidt can testify to that. So I figured that it's not my bag. I didn't like gambling. But very, very early in my career, I had worked as a student of statistics on a book that was published a long time ago called The Science of Betting by Dorcas and DeSilva. And I knew from my memories of that betting parimutuel could be a winning lesson in itself, very small, just by knowing the odds, playing the odds, something which Ziemba and Hausch allegedly reproved several years later. Not a real good chance of winning, but a small, slim margin, making it a positive expectancy event. And the best of the thoroughbred, the best of the pari-mutuel events that paid the highest amount of money was thoroughbred racing. Quarter horse racing and harness racing did not reward you odds-wise for the winner to the degree that thoroughbred did. So we concentrated on thoroughbred racing quite simply. Now, what we call a coefficient of correlation in statistics is when, and you decide, have to decide what you're correlating. Our decision was that we would find four factors, one of which won 68% of the time. And we would have to find variables from Tom Ainslie's 186. That's it. We had to go by the books of the time. And Tom Ainslie had a book called Encyclopedia of Thoroughbred Racing, and he said there were 186 variables that contributed to the winning of a race. So in a room about half this size with high walls, we got butcher paper and hung them on the walls, and we started checking on Tom Ainslie's 186 variables. And only six of them had anything to do with winning a race 68% of the time in the top four. The rest of them were eliminated. And the ones that were eliminated are primarily the things that hang you up right now. Trainer and jockey situations. Trainer maneuvers. A double drop. Switch to a top jockey. The reason that those of you who still believe that trainers and jockeys make the race and not the horse itself, the reason you believe that is because you're conspiracy-oriented, and there's nothing wrong with that. Most human beings are conspiracy-oriented, and they think. But unless man has a hand in it, it can't go right. That the horse, that stupid horse can't win the race. You got to get to know those guys on the backstretch, and then you really got the inside information. And so long as the world believes that, those of us who do not are safe. The only problem that vexes me is that subconsciously, closetly, or openly, too many of our people think that trainers and jockeys make the race. One thing we know now, having been public for 10 years almost, is that we have demonstrated unequivocally that the horse and the horse alone, knowing about what that horse can do, will win the race enough times to make you a good living. Anybody who does not accept that has got two strikes against you, but he's not out. I respect the fact that a lot of you will say he's nuts. But you just someday just do, have a little more open mind. Handicap the horse on one sheet of paper and handicap the trainer and the jockey on another sheet of paper and see at the end of 20 races which you get the most from. Jockeys, the best jockey in the world wins somewhere around 20%. The best trainer wins around 21% year in and year out. Now, the trainer advocates say, oh, yeah, that's true. They never win more than 21% year in and year out. But if you know that trainer's modus operandi, when he drops it three times and moves into the three hole with a jockey wearing purple silks, he has a 36% advantage. The problem with finding that 36% advantage is finding it to begin with, and then the time that you make the bet will be one of the 36. You really have a heck of a problem when you try to let a human being surpass the capacity of a horse. The trainers themselves don't believe they do this, and the jockeys themselves don't think they believe this. I wonder why the mass of the racing public does. You read Stephen Crist in your own New York papers, one of the most knowledgeable writers in the thoroughbred scene, says jockeys have virtually nothing to do with it. He interviewed a bunch of jockeys to demonstrate it. Stephen is a Harvard man. He went to Harvard at the same time that Andy Byer did, although he finished. He didn't go to the Belmont that day. Charlie Whittingham's a very good friend of ours. Charlie Whittingham took our figures to his barn. He said, very logical, very good, marvelous stuff. Says, but my only problem with him is, I put one of these goddamn little size, pardon me, this is the way he talks, ladies, and he uses worse language than that, one of these size 3 hats on it, and I tell him to hold the horse back a little bit. What is it? Do but hold it back 15 lengths, And by the time he's ready to make a move, you know, you can't be that far behind at the second call. He comes in last. Now I tell the little size 3 hat to go out and take a lead. So he goes out and he takes a 14-length lead, runs the first quarter in 21-1, and he's dead before the two-quarter pole. He has very little use for jockeys. Charlie Whittingham Flatley says that the three worst handicappers in the world are first owners, second trainers, and third jockeys. Eddie R. Carroll said, let me have the booking rights in the jockey room and I'll make a fortune. So if you are going to put your future in the hands of these people, then you are really being foolish. Because we have some trainers who use our method for placing horses, and they say, you guys are much better than we are because you can scratch your horse any time. We can't. By scratch, they mean you don't have to bet it. If we find our horse can't match up with who they put in the race today, we're stuck with it unless we can scratch him in time. But after a certain time in the morning, only the veterinarian can scratch a horse. You can scratch your horse any time. Wayne Lucas put his finger on it. I'm not too fond of Wayne Lucas, but he did say something that was very, very accurate. He said, each horse has a running style of his own. We call it a behavioral pattern. He calls it a running style. And there is very, very little that any trainer or any jockey can do to alter that running style. They can alter it a small amount, but not significantly. And the most important thing he said about it is that a good trainer and a good jockey will merely get the most out of that particular style. A trainer can bring the horse up into top shape so that the jockey can rate that horse according to the horse's own desired, manifest, inherent style of running. Well, the first thing that we did, if you will notice in your manuals, is to determine the behavioral pattern of a horse and to capitalize in it. The whole concept of the matchup, of matching horses together, is to determine which horse will take the lead, which horse can press it, which horse can sustain it, run against it, close on it. And by so doing, we just about can figure out who's going to win the race without even turning on a computer. Jimmy Bradshaw, whom you meet tonight, says his definition of the horse race is hell. One of them horses goes out and gets the lead, and the others chase it. And if they can catch up with it, they win the race. If they can't, he's going to win the race. That's the best description of a horse race I ever heard. That's exactly what happens. They're all chasing somebody who gets on ahead early. Horses do have, and this is one thing you must accept. If you don't accept this, you've got two strikes on you again. You must accept the fact that horses have distinctive, personal, behavioral patterns which are rarely subject to much alteration by anything a man can do. Get them young enough, sure, you can hold the horse, an early horse back. But after they're 3-year-olds, you better accept the fact that what you see in the racing form, the style they manifest in the racing form, is pretty much the behavior pattern you're all going to get. And that behavioral pattern is something that the most important thing we have that the public doesn't have is that we know statistically from long study that the behavioral pattern of a horse is manifest mostly in the second fraction. Now, the second fraction is hidden from the public. How many of you used to extrapolate the second fraction before you joined us? How many extrapolate the second fraction since you joined us? Good. The public, as you undoubtedly know, does not see that second fraction. I spent 4 hours of the first seminar we ever did trying to explain there was a difference between the second fraction and the second call, and they weren't buying it in New Orleans. 4 hours it took me to show them there was an interval between that first call time and that second call time, and it was the second fraction. They couldn't see it. So if they couldn't see it with a book and diagrams, The public doesn't see that. Now, the public has a good index of the first fraction. You'll hear public say, hey, look at the speed's holding on. The speed, that's, you know, the first fraction. Or maybe they're looking at the second call. And they do have some sense of what the third fraction is because I hear them say, hey, look at that horse makes a big move. He closes real good. But they do not see the second fraction. And that is the key to a horse's behavior. We did a statistical study and found that the least deviation in the horse's time and style was in the second fraction. The longer the race, the least meaningful it is, but at all sprints and one-turn routes, there was less deviation in the second fraction than any of the other quarters. The most deviation is in the third, and there's quite a deviation in the first fraction in velocity. But the second fraction had the least deviation because feeling good or feeling bad, the horse will do what he usually does in turn time, which is our second fraction. So automatically, you know that the second fraction has great importance in the race. And I call your attention to that because tonight and tomorrow and the next 3 days, Tom Brohammer will be talking extensively about what we call turn time. Andy Beyer interviewed Tom here not too long ago. It appeared in the Washington Post and syndication work. Tom showed how a horse the best turn or the second best turn time, the other one was so ridiculously far behind the first it didn't count, but the horse with truly the best turn time relative to his other fractions would win that race about 75% of the time. Andy revealed that, but he didn't reveal it enough that the public's ever going to realize what gift they got. The whole standard of what we're trying to do, which is make a living at the track, our whole standard is to see things that the public doesn't.